Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for September 17th, 2007, and on this episode, we have an interview with Sean Cross. She talks to Tom Williams about her role in Cymbeline, now playing at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. And of course, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is from Chicago Shakespeare's very funny and very terrific production of Cymbeline, and this young lady is one of the stars of the show, and I think she's the one that really carries the show. So say hello, Sean Cross.
Hi.
Sean, you are just terrific. I've been following your career for a number of years, and I think you're one of the finest classical Shakespearean actors working today.
Well, what a compliment. Thank you for that.
Well,
very generous.
And, you know, some people have said that this play should be called Imogen because of the strength of your character, that you're one of the character you play is one of Shakespeare's strongest female characters.
Yeah, I would agree. The play does follow her story most closely, I would say. And Shakespeare does write a really full, interesting, you know, humorous, virtuous character that's very interesting. So I agree, it kind of should be called Imogen, but none of these plays are named after women, are they?
I don't think he has any of them named after women. I'm not sure, though. That's a trivia question. It's out of my character. So tell us what we can expect when folks come down to Chicago Shakespeare to see the show.
The unexpected is what you can expect. It's a funny play. It's one of the late romances that he wrote, which sort of are a mishmash of comedy and tragedy and history. So once you think you're going down one road of, you know, a tragedy, then he'll turn and make you laugh, and then back again, you'll care about the characters, and then there's a war and headless men, and what you can expect is a little bit of everything, I think, as the romances deliver. And also in our production, it's a lot of fun. It's visually beautiful. It's a sort of a raucous fairy tale.
It sure is.
Fairy tale, yeah.
Yes, and again, at Chicago Shakespeare, the production values are always so strong. And casting, I mean, you're in with a great A-list of classical actors.
I agree. It's every time that I've worked there, I get to work with some amazing people because everybody does want to work at such a beautiful house and, you know, just to have the opportunity to do these texts and to play these roles. Everybody sort of collaborates at this theater, so.
I didn't know that you were as good at comedy as you are. I mean, you landed some terrific lines.
Well, I have to say, I've never considered myself a comic actor. I guess I can be funny in my real life, but this is written in. I mean, Imogen just has some really funny moments, and, you know, I think that if you play comedy honestly, especially in this play, then it will be funny. I mean, Shakespeare does just give you everything, absolutely everything you need.
Yeah, tell us about Imogen, you know, a little bit of the plot line of what she does, because she's kind of the anchor character for the show.
Yeah, it starts out, Imogen is the Princess of Britain. She's Cymbeline's daughter. And she's wed a commoner for love, but this is obviously upsetting to the king, her father, because he's not royalty. So he banishes Posthumus, who is the man that she married, and imprisons her. So that's where you start. You start at this sort of, like, tragic situation. Now, also, Cymbeline has recently remarried the wife you never meet. She's apparently dead. But he has recently remarried this queen, who has a son, and she wants that son to marry Imogen so that they'll have more power and be closer to the crown. So, and she's got great influence and sway over Cymbeline, so she's sort of your archetypical, like, you know, wicked queen, wicked stepmother, really, is exactly what she is. And her son, Cloten, is sort of a buffoonish villain but like a funny villain. You know, he's not too dangerous. Although he is. He is.
Yeah, I think he is.
He's going to go and rape Imogen, you know, and kill her husband. So, I mean, you know, this whole play sort of weaves tragedy and comedy.
But yet, Brian Sills plays him as kind of a comic buffoon.
He is, but he's also a maniac. Do you know what I mean? I mean, Brian is a comic genius, I think. I think
he is. I agree.
Hilarious.
I agree.
But so he can't help but just make everything he touches funny. But then also, you know, like this character just is a total maniac, and he's just on a path of destruction. You know, he wants to just destroy because of whatever his reasonings are. So, I mean, he is a funny character, but then when you really, you know, look at what he's doing and listen to some of his words, he'll turn around and you're like, ooh, gosh, what a horrible, horrible villainous.
Yes, because, yeah, there's some scenes there where he's quite intense. That's correct. So now Imogen still loves Posthumus, and she wants to go find him, and she has help from her servant, who is played by Joel Hatch, who's one of our great veteran actors. That was some cool chemistry between the two of you.
Well, he's wonderful. He's like, it's sort of like this father, brother, servant, master, best friend, all-encompassing relationship that Imogen and Pisanio have. Pisanio is the servant that Posthumus has left behind. Posthumus has been banished, and he's gone to Spain. But he left his servant behind to look after Imogen and sort of be the go-between between the two of them. And once Imogen goes looking for Posthumus in Cambria or in Wales into the wilderness, Pisanio goes with her and is really her greatest ally through the whole story. Now, because of twists and turns, she doesn't realize that. At one stage, she thinks he's trying to kill her, and at one stage, she thinks that he killed her husband. And so there's all kinds of confusion, you know, that go along with it. But really, Pisanio and Imogen are the two characters that stick together through the whole play. And it's great chemistry between those two characters. And thank God I'm, you know, working with Joel Hatch. So, yeah, I love working with him.
Yeah, and it comes off. It's one of the more unique relationships from Shakespeare.
It is. It's great. Like I said, it's all-encompassing because they're best friends, but they're not that close because they're servant and master, and he's sort of fathering her, and, you know, it's fun. It's a really beautiful relationship.
So tell us about the scene when you're sleeping and the Italian's trying to win a diamond ring. I mean, I thought that was a terrific scene. Give us a little clue or a little hint about that.
Okay, well, this story, you know, encompasses so much of every other story you've heard, you know, Shakespeare stories and fairy tales, but here we have, just like in Troilus and Cressida, we have the two lovers exchanging love gifts. They're being separated so that they exchange tokens to, you know, be a symbol of their faithfulness. So Imogen was given a bracelet from Posthumus, and she has given him a diamond ring. So Posthumus goes to Italy, and Iacomo picks on Posthumus because Posthumus is saying that he is the most virtuous wife in the world, and Iacomo dares him that he could go and win over his wife and get her to be not virtuous. So he bets the ring, and he bets that diamond ring that Imogen would not be unfaithful. So Iacomo goes to Britain and tries to win Imogen through intellect and through trickery. It doesn't work. So he resorts to hiding in a trunk. That the trunk is stored in Imogen's bedroom. So when she's sleeping, then he climbs out of the trunk, and he's got this wonderful scene where he's, you know, slithering all around her bedroom, looking at the bedroom and taking details down so that he can tell Posthumus he knows what the bedroom, you know, getting all sorts of information that will prove to Posthumus that he's been in her bedroom and, you know, taken
that was
her honor, basically.
It was a wonderful scene.
Yeah, it's just the most dramatic, fun, disgusting, all at once, the sort of...
And I love the way you put him down tell us about the Canadian actor who's playing him. I think he's terrific.
Juan Triorn is so wonderful. He is. He's like this play. He's like a great mix of a dramatic actor, you know, and he's always cast as a villain because he's sort of built.
Yeah, and he's got that big voice, yeah.
Yeah, he's got a huge voice, and he just looks like, you know, a villain. But he's hilarious, too. He's got great comic timing, and he really plays this part just beautifully. That's all I can really say about Juan. I mean, Juan can do whatever you ask him to do, and he's a great villain, because these villains, like I said, they're not as serious as a villain in, you know, as Iago would be in Othello. They're very similar, but Iacomo pops out of a trunk. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He doesn't kill anybody. He steals her bracelet, you know, and then goes and lies about what he did. He didn't actually rape her, and you know what I mean?
So yeah.
These villains come very close to being horrible, horrible people, but then at the end of the day, they're also just comic villains.
Yeah, and they don't quite wink to the audience, but they kind of give a few clues. They give a few looks, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so now Imogene is she ends up going looking after their husband, and she has all kinds of adventures, and you end up being dressed and playing a little boy in some scenes.
Yeah.
That must have been fun.
Well, yeah, she gets in the predicament where, there's all kinds of misunderstanding. So we've talked about how Iacomo goes back and tells Posthumus that he's made her untrue, and he proves it to her because he's stolen her bracelet. And so this makes Posthumus believe that she slept with him. So he goes nuts and writes to Pisanio, his servant, and says, "Kill her. I want you to kill her." So Pisanio, being the good servant that he is not going to kill Imogen. He instead takes her to Wales and says, "Look, you've got to get out of here. I'm going to write and tell him that you're dead, but you are going to disappear. You're going to dress like a boy and go and find this Roman captain, Caius Lucius, because he's a good man. He'll take you in. You can be his page and, you know, then make your way back to the court, and hopefully everything will be sorted out." So her trip through Cambria, through Wales, which is the sort of like the forest in, you know, Midsummer Night's Dream, it's people going into nature and going into the wilderness to sort of find themselves. She dresses like a boy, and she's on the search for Caius Lucius, and she runs into these two wild boys that live with Valerius. They're all in disguise. Valerius has stolen Imogen's two brothers at a young age, and he's raised them in the wild. Now, she doesn't know that they're her brothers, but they sort of save her life because she's starving, she's been wandering through the wilderness, and they take her in, and they're very nice to her. So she gets to stay with them for a while, but she gets real sick, so she drinks a poison that that Pisanio gave her that he got from the Wicked Queen.
But he thought was good, right? Yeah.
Yeah, thinking that it was medicinal. So Pisanio gave it to Imogen in good faith, but in fact, the Wicked Queen had given him poison trying to kill Imogen. But what you don't know is that the doctor that gave the poison to the queen doesn't like the queen or trust her, so he didn't actually give her poison. He gave her a sleeping potion instead. So it wouldn't kill her or anybody that took it. It would just put them to sleep, like in Romeo and Juliet or something like that. So Imogen ends up taking the sleeping potion and waking up next to a dead body, which is a whole nother strain of the story. I'm giving the whole story away.
Yeah, well, not quite. There's just so many twists. But some of those cute scenes with the two young actors that play these kind of wild boys were hilarious.
Well, it's great fun just to watch someone, you know, trying to play that role, to watch a woman trying to play the role of a boy and handle herself in this, you know, stressed circumstance, you know, and play herself off as a boy. And that is a lot of fun to do. And it's so much fun to dress up like a boy and have a sword and, you know, try to walk and talk and be confused and not good at it.
Come in with a little slapstick there. You kind of fall over the sword.
I mean, the opening line to that monologue is, "I see a man's life as a tedious one." So I thought, you know, What would be tedious about wandering around? And, you know, you've got these boots on and these leather pants and a big sword and all this kind of layered gear and stuff. So I figured, you know, a woman wouldn't know how to move in that. So the first thing I found was that you need to trip over yourself.
So that was the little bit you added, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously Barbara Gaines liked it, huh?
She did, yep. She said, "Go ahead and go for that and do it bigger and faster and funnier."
So this is one of the shows that not only entertains everyone so well, but one of the things it does is the energy from the cast, whether it's, you know, a high dramatic scene or a funny scene, you guys are just have such a high energy, and it comes across like you're having such fun with the show.
Well, it is. It is a lot of fun. It's such an adventure. Like you said, you know, I mean, it's one thing after another. It's headless bodies and sleeping potions and wild boys and, you know, wicked queens and, you know, I mean, just it's just jam-packed with comedy, tragedy, war, I mean, everything.
Yeah, there's
But it all sort of resolves it with something real that touches everyone, which is, you know, forgiveness. And
yeah, reconciliation, correct. And there's a fabulous sword fight in the show that's just...
Of course,
yeah.
There are. There are a couple wonderful fights.
Yeah. And how is Larry Yondo to work with? I mean, talk about a guy with a presence. I mean, perfect casting, him playing the king.
Yeah, he's great fun. I mean, he's so good at what he does. He can sort of do a million things at once. You know, he can be in a very serious, heartfelt scene and then and sort of depart into comedy and then come right back, you know, without flinching. He's a lot of fun to watch and be on stage with because you never really know what to expect. He's always keeping you on your toes.
Well, how is it working with him when a lot of people have taken his classes? Because I know he's one of the top Shakespearean instructors around.
Yeah, well, he's also been very helpful in the rehearsal process with the verse. He actually gave a couple classes on the first folio technique, which is what we use at Chicago Shakespeare. And so initially he was sort of in charge of making sure everybody was on the same page about how we're going to deal with the text. And, you know, he's been really open about just offering up, you know, suggestions on, you know, problems that people are having with the text. So he was our text coach through our...
Oh, I didn't know that. That can't have...
Very valuable.
Yeah, I was going to say that certainly helps. And it's... So it's all about learning for you guys, too, besides, you know, doing your craft. When you get a chance to work with masters like that, years from now, you're gonna say, hey, I work with Larry Yondo and Barbara
Absolutely.
Gaines.
Yeah. I mean, that's the game, isn't it? I mean, I think as an actor, you just sort of collect information and bits and pieces from all the people that you've worked with, you know, whether it be good or bad, you collect information and sort of use it to make your own craft. And yeah, learning, I don't think I could... to do this if there wasn't some sort of learning involved, curve, you know, involved. Because that's what makes you excited about what you're doing and keeps you on your toes and keeps you from getting comfortable and just pulling out the same old shtick every time you work. You know, you want to do something that challenges you and that you're not sure that you can do so that, you know, I think challenge makes for very good work.
Well, tell us how you prepare for 8 shows a week, and I know you have several days in the week. You do 2 shows in one day. How do you mentally and physically, you know, stay at the top of your craft with that kind of a schedule?
Well, just rest. You know, making real sure that you know you find your time to rest. That's a big one, just because we have odd hours. You know, we get home at 11:30 at night, and you know you have to wind down, and then you know. My temptation is to sleep in every day, but, you know, you still have to have, like, a normal life and take care of your day life. So finding your own schedule of rest is huge. I personally really like to do some sort of exercise before the shows just to get the blood pumping and the mind quickened, you know, a lot of warming up with the mouth and so you can spit out all those words. And, you know, it's just a routine of getting your body and your tool ready to... do a 2-hour Shakespeare play and really deliver all those words.
So that physical exercise helps get you into the mental tone of it? I mean, you know, because...
Absolutely. Just because the agility that you need when you're speaking the language, I mean, the language moves faster than your brain does sometimes because, you know, Shakespeare writes living thought. So these people, you know, aren't thinking about what they're going to say and then saying it. Sort of, you're just sort of like living and speaking at the same time. So that sort of mental agility, blood pumping to the brain, helps.
Well, let me add a little compliment there. Is not only this production, but in all the work I've seen you do, you are definitely one of the most articulate people. You can understand every word, and that is so crucial in the classics, particularly Shakespeare. And you know, as I've said, I should non-equity Shakespeare. Sometimes that's the problem. You know, they run the words together, blah, 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 you know, and you can't understand anything. And they don't know where the emphasis is, so you just tune it out. But your show was just so articulate, everybody, and you in particular were very strong.
Thank you. That's such a compliment. I mean, I think above all, that is what I hope most for, you know, a Shakespeare, other than the glorification of God in some way, but for a Shakespeare play, I want it to be understandable because at the end of the day, that's all you really need are the words.
Yeah, well, the words and where to put the emphasis on them, too.
Clarity.
And I'm big on that. That's my pet peeve, and like in musicals, is when people throw away a line or throw away the end of a phrase, you know, in a song, and you don't quite get it. You know,
yeah. I mean, that's the meat of the storytelling. So, yeah, I mean, really, if you know and understand what you're saying and say it clearly, then the story will be told, you know, whether or not you've got the costume or the prop or the scene. You know, really the language is the key. So thank you for that. That's such a great compliment.
Well, and I mean that. And as I said, that's on the other end of it, I can be brutal on that when people don't. But that's why I tell people, go to Chicago Shakespeare, where, you know, the production values, the people they cast, and you know, it's just so entertaining. And I have a friend of mine came to the show who's now reviewing for me, who had never seen a Chicago Shakespeare production but had seen many in London, lived in London for a while. He was blown away. He said, this is better. He said, I know you were telling me that, you know, the Chicago Shakespeare is better than the productions in London, but he goes, you know, I had to see for myself. And he agreed.
Wow. Well, that's quite a compliment, too. I mean, the two styles, I think, are very different, you know, American productions of Shakespeare and English, but what a compliment, you know.
Okay, let's talk now about some of your background. I mean, you just didn't, you know, arrive here and get major roles in Shakespeare. Give us a little bit of your, you know, where you studied and where your background, some of the other shows that you've done.
Sure. Well, I'm originally from Arkansas, and...
You are from Arkansas?
I am. I'm from Eureka Springs, Arkansas.
Well, you don't have any of the Arkansas in you that I can hear.
I don't. I lost it. We lived in California for a while as well, and that took the accent right out of me. But I sure can bring it back whenever I want to.
Oh, I'm sure.
So then I went to I did my undergraduate program. I got my Bachelor of Fine Arts at Stevens College in Columbia, Missouri, which is a small private women's college that had a wonderful theater program. And out of college, I toured for 2 years with Shenandoah Shakespeare, a company that is in Stanton, Virginia. Wonderful company. I would say that was my grad school. And
I've heard of them, and I think I saw one production.
They're a great company. And sort of learned Clarity of Shakespeare, I think, from them, from Ralph Cohen and Jim Warren. They're a great company. So I toured for 2 years with them, and then had to choose a city to live in. So I chose Chicago, and moved here in 2001. And so I've been here for, 6 years now?
All right, what brought you to Chicago?
Well, it was the first place I was moving out on my own, so I sort of counted New York out, being a country girl and, you know, striking out all by myself. I decided maybe New York was a maybe too big, bad, and mean to go first.
I can understand that.
I didn't have the interest, yeah. And I also lived in Southern California for 6 years. And I knew I didn't want to be out there right now. Just the industry out there wasn't conducive to what I wanted to be doing. I wanted to really focus on theater. So in Chicago's, you know, it's a 12-hour drive from Arkansas, but it's still, you know, in my neck of the woods in that it's central. It's, you know, sort of Midwest-ish and a lot more, you know, I just felt like it was the nicer of cities that you could have a quality of lifestyle here. And also have all the amenities of a big city, metropolitan.
Plus, we do a lot of classical shows here, too. There's opportunity for top
actors. I admit, I didn't really know that at the time. I did know about Chicago Shakespeare Theater and dreamt of working there one day. So, and actually called Bob Mason before I even moved here and set up a general audition and came in and auditioned for him. So I did know that I wanted to work on that stage one day.
Well, that's terrific. And you went after your goal. That's what people ought to do. But I recently remember you in Grace at Northlight.
Mm-hmm. That was, that's right. I have.
And you did Uncle Vanya and some stuff at Court Theater too.
Yeah, the Court Theater is one of my favorites in town.
Yeah, they are great.
Artistic home, and I've worked a lot with them. So yeah, they're a great theater as well. And yeah, recently did Uncle Vanya with them. But I also did Cymbeline and Pericles in the Romance Cycle.
That's right. I remember that. You guys were barefoot running around in white togas.
That's right.
And it was fun because in between they fed us. I mean, that talk about taking care of the audience. Yeah, I remember that. That was high energy. And that was a major production.
That's a lot of fun, too. Yeah, and dealt again with these wild, woolly, crazy romances. It was a lot of fun.
Well, your career is just exploding now. And how many shows have Chicago Shakespeare have you done?
This is my fourth.
This
I
is
started,
your fourth?
Yeah, I started with Taming the Shrew, and then this season I've been blessed to be able to do The Two Noble Kinsmen and Troilus and Cressida, and now Cymbeline.
Those are terrific shows. All right, what do you have coming up after this? Do you have anything lined up after this?
I have a trip to Ireland to visit my in-laws and some time off to sort of refuel, as all artists should do, I think. I'm going to devote some time to just, being a real person for a while and spending time with my husband. I have a few things in the pipeline, but I don't have a job booked for...
Well, every time I hear that from a top actor, then about a week later or a couple days later, I get a press release.
How it works. You're always the last one to know what your next job is. So I'm just going to trust that something will come and that it'll be the right thing.
Okay, give us an idea of what your goals are. Where are you going to be, or where do you want to be in your profession, say 5 years from now?
I've got a couple. I would love to work in England. My husband's Irish, and that's a big draw to live and work in England, just to be closer to his family would be something I'd like to do in my life. And I've always wanted to work at the Royal Shakespeare Company, so that would be a goal. Also, I really want to work in film at some stage. I've always been into directing. Even as a little girl with a video camera, I've been making little movies here and there. So I love film. I love the medium. I've never moved to L.A. or tried to pursue it wholeheartedly, but it's always been a passion of mine. So I'd love to film as well.
With your beauty and the way you can present yourself on stage, the camera's going to love you.
And I hope so.
And you know what a lot of casting directors in film have told me through the years, because I had a very good friend that is an expert on film, taught film. He said they love stage actors because, you can learn lines, you can be in character. Because many times in film, they rarely rehearse. They just keep shooting it over until they, get the angle or whatever they want.
It's a very different process.
Yeah, and then but with stage actors, the director talks to you, here's how we want to play it, and I'll be darned if you guys don't get it the first or second time. Because your craft. Yeah.
Our discipline, yeah.
Yeah, right. And the same thing with learning lines. Most of the stage actors come there and they have the whole, they're off book and even know almost everyone else's part. And some of the, quote, what I'll call lazy film actors, even the, quote, big stars, they have to dub their stuff in. They can't learn 10 lines. This kind of training.
That'll come in handy.
Yeah, this kind of training you're getting, from what I've heard, it's just a matter of time before you get up there and make the big bucks.
Yeah, and that's kind of what it is. There's a lot of money tempting you into that industry, but I just think that film is just another way of, telling a story and reaching people that's very clear.
I agree.
I have to say my heart and soul will always come back to the theater because it is.
Well, that's what Gary Sinise and John Mahoney and some of the people who have been successful in film and television will say. They have to get back on the stage when they can, because it's not about money. It's about that interaction with the audience and that.
Absolutely. Immediate communication with a live audience. There's just nothing like it.
Well, I wish you the best. Just keep up the great work. And, folks, you got to get out to Shakespeare to see this absolutely wonderful production. Thank you so much, and we wish you the best.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you Chicago's theater news for the week of September 17th, 2007. Passion is coming to the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. That's right, the Tony Award-winning musical Passion by Stephen Sondheim will be gracing the Chicago stages and will have a stellar cast led by Anna Gasteyer, Adam Brazier, and Kathy Voitko. Passion will be directed by Chicago Shakespeare Theater Associate Artistic Director Gary Griffin, who will be returning to Chicago after directing The Color Purple on Broadway. Gary Griffin has established himself as one of America's leading directors of musical theater and of directing Sondheim, not only here in Chicago and New York, but also in London as well. He is well known for his show Pacific Overtures, which won him the honor of 5 Jeff Awards here in Chicago, as well as 3 Laurence Olivier Awards in London. Performances for this hit Passion will start on October 2nd at the Upstairs Theater at Chicago Shakes. Tickets can be purchased by calling Chicago Shakespeare Theater's box office at 312-595-5600. Again, that's 312-595-5600. Or you can click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Coming Soon section. Looking Glass Theater kicks off its 20th anniversary season with the Midwest premiere of No Child, a solo show by Nilaja Sun. The show is being directed by Hal Brooks and starts on October 3rd at the Looking Glass Theater Company, which is located inside of Chicago's historic Water Tower Water Works facility. Sun plays multiple characters in a touching tour de force exploration of the public school system seen through the eyes of an idealistic teaching artist. The show won 2 2007 Outer Critics Circle Awards, a Lucille Lortel Award, an Obie Award, and the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival Jury Award. For more information on how you can get tickets to see Nilaja Sun's No Child, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Coming Soon section. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from Troilus and Cressida, Act 1, Scene 2. Men prize the thing ungained more than it is. Well, this is the part of the podcast where I remind you that we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So, until next week, Chicago, I'm your host, Dustin Moat. I'll be here to bring you some more theater news that you can always use. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Sean Cross for giving us the honor of interviewing her this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode, ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.